This is an oral history interview with Charles Center, who was Professor Emeritus of business. The date is December 17th, 1987. I'm Laura Smale, doing the interview for the University of Wisconsin Archives Oral History Project. Now, Mr. Center, one of the virtues of oral history is that one can jump around because one can easily find places on the tape, so we don't have to start at the beginning. We may go back to the beginning later, but you had started
we were talking about Dean Elwell.
Yes.
And I had indicated that he managed what was first the Department of Commerce and then became the School of Commerce. Very much through the fear, creating great fear in the minds of all of his faculty. He was on an entirely different level as far as they were concerned. He drove some people away who were good people and who couldn't stomach it. And I learned very early to avoid him as much as possible. And it stemmed from this little incident that in 1946, when I came as an assistant professor, I was within a year, in effect, a department chairman for risk and insurance. And I wanted scholarship money for our students, graduate and undergraduate, so I began to cultivate insurance industry people at every opportunity. One of the first was Frank Horner, who I knew otherwise, who was general agent for the Northwestern Mutual. So I went to Frank, and after a good bit of visiting, he agreed to work with the three other Northwestern Mutual general agents in the state and see what they would do. He came back and said that they would give $2,250 apiece, or $1,000 a year, for student scholarships with no strings attached, whether undergraduate just left the entire direction of the expenditure to us. Well, I thought that was great. That was my first breakthrough, the lead cow toward what I hoped would be many other such. And it didn't turn out to be that way. You've got to crack the ice. So there, in connection with all these gifts and grants, there's what we call the conditions of award, which is simply a one or two page typewritten statement outlining the nature of the gift, the uses, its approval by donor and donee. So I borrowed from the dean's secretary an existing condition of award, just as a pattern, made a couple of very slight changes in it, only to indicate that we in the department had more flexibility, more freedom to use this money for student scholarships or perhaps for library expenditures in the field, that sort of thing, than the conditions which had been loaned me from the office for the pattern. So after the new one was mildly revised, typed up, I got Frank Horner to sign it, of course. And then it had to be signed by the dean as acceptable to the school or the department. So with a good deal of self-satisfaction, of course, and some pride, I took it into the dean's office and left it with his secretary, got a call. Next day, Dean Elwell would like to see you. Why, that isn't this great? He's going to congratulate me. I went in, and to put it bluntly, he simply chewed me out because I had had the temerity to change, whether for better or worse, a sentence or two in the conditions of awards, which I suppose he had drafted at some earlier time. Well, that so-and-so. if that's the way he runs this school, I'm going to stay away as far from as possible. And I learned later, of course, from many others, he drove away very good members of the faculty simply because he wouldn't listen to anybody. He didn't know what discussion meant. He would make a decision, pound the table, this is it, for better or for worse.
What happened on the statement finally?
Oh, he approved it. He signed it. But as far as telling me, Charlie, you've done a nice piece of work here, all I got was a bawling out for having made the change. That's absolutely all. Never so much as a compliment. Where do we go now?
Well, I wondered if you had any other encounters.
Let's not talk about Dean Elwell anymore.
He hired you, did he?
Technically, I suppose you'd say so, because he was then the chairman of the department. Actually, I had been here from 1937 to 41, doing my graduate work, getting a master's and a PhD. My major professor was Baird Taylor, whom I liked very much and respected highly. He was a business finance. At that time, the Commerce Department occupied the fourth floor of Sterling Hall, the Economics Department the third floor. And Baird had a joint appointment in both departments. Most of my graduate work was in economics rather than in commerce. As I look back, I can recall and think about many of the eminent professors of economics of the late 1930s. But practically nobody except Baird, who had a foot in the Department of Commerce. So I became his teaching assistant in business finance. I suppose he was desperate. I had no particular qualifications. There was in the program, the School of Commerce, a course outline, listing, three courses in risk and insurance, but nobody had taught them for a while. Irv Gomnitz, who eventually succeeded Elwell as then the dean of the School of Commerce, was and a Minnesota PhD, was hired. Irv was primarily a statistician, but he'd been working in the Minnesota State, the Department of Unemployment Insurance, and that word insurance was the key to his employment here. Even though this was entirely different, it was principally private insurance, the private insurance institution. Way back after I'd graduated from Knox College in 1932, and when one was desperate for anything to do that might make a dollar, I had tried to sell insurance. I was the world's worst salesman, but at least I had learned to read a rate book. So when Irv came down from Minnesota to our school, he immediately became a very popular lecturer, and enrollment in his basic course was something over 100, which was in those days quite big, pre-World War II. Mm. Well, he needed a teaching assistant. He and Baird Taylor were good friends. My wife, Libby, and I were social friends with both the Taylors and the Gomnitzes because, you see, I was a somewhat elderly graduate student, having spent 5 years in high school work between graduation from Knox and beginning a graduate program here. So that we were good friends on the outside as well as the inside of the school. So that it was agreed that I would take quiz sections for Irv as well as Baird, which gave me about all I could manage. I think it was 5 quiz sections a week. Now, where am I going? What was the original point, please?
Of how you happened to get on the faculty of the School of Commerce. I had asked you if Elwell hired you, and you...
Well, I finished a PhD in 1941, went to the University of Missouri, this sounds very egotistical, but it is still a matter of pride that after all the preliminary examinations for the PhD were done in the Department of Economics, economic theory, economic history, etc., I don't remember, in your field, your major and the minor and so on, that professors Witte and Kiekhofer asked me to stop in the econ department office to tell me that my preliminary examinations had been the best they had seen in many, many years. So I thought, well, maybe I'm not so stupid after all. But that was a little bit of a record, let's say, left behind me when I finished and went to the University of Missouri. The war came on, and I bureaucrated 2 years with the Office of Price Administration and 3 years as a director of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, first Dallas, then New York City. And in the spring of 1946, when it was clear that the war was over, I wrote a personal letter to Irv Gomnitz and said, I'm on leave from the University of Missouri. I can go back there. I like the place. But do you know of any other openings that I might consider? In no sense was I thinking of Wisconsin. I just wasn't that smart. But almost immediately, Irv took my letter, obviously, went in to see Elwell, and with his usual power to persuade Elwell, I had immediately got a reply, would you come here as an assistant professor at 2800? Well, I hardly looked at that 2800. As a matter of fact, 2800 was what the University of Missouri was paying me in 1941. And as the Bureau of Labor Statistics director, my salary was 7,500, which was big money, great, huge money in 1946.
Yes.
We were so happy. We loved Madison so much that without even giving a thought to salary, I just wrote back, of course, we're glad to come. So that's how we came back to Wisconsin after the interval of a year at the University of Missouri and 5 war years, 4 war.
Had you had any courses with Elwell?
Never. He taught accounting only. No, I was virtually all my own graduate coursework was in economics. Mm-hmm. I spent some time with Baird Taylor, my major professor in business finance. I soon learned that my major interest, really, was in private finance rather than public. Harold Groves, Professor Harold Groves, taught the area of taxation, public finance. Baird Taylor taught the area of business or corporate finance. There was a niche which attracted me in the area of personal finance, of working with people in terms of, and it developed out of the risk and insurance program as we were teaching students, teaching courses in risk and the management of various kinds of risks, which involved not simply insurance, but other techniques. And then there was a natural flow from that into personal finance, into the building of investments, savings, the planning of estates. Eventually I ended up offering a senior level course in that alone.
How did you decide or did you have to get permission to give the courses you wanted to? How was that worked out?
I don't remember. There's a lot of red tape involved. It had to be approved by the administration of your department or school. And then whether or not it was necessary to go on beyond the department approval to school approval, I suppose there were committees at the time. I don't recall that now.
I guess I really meant, did you have to discuss this with Elwell?
No. I had no personal contact with Elwell.
Even though he was
He was the director of the Department of Commerce, or chairman, rather, of the Department of Commerce, until when would it have been? 1944, 1945, along in there, perhaps? The archives, the record will show, it became an independent school separate from Letters and Science.
And yes, and at 46.
46.
And then he became dean.
He became dean instead of chairman. Mm-hmm. And he and Mark Ingram were cat and dog. And, of course, I think perhaps both of them were delighted to have a divorce. Mark was then, dean of the Letters and Science School.
Mm-hmm. So your coming had nothing to do with the fact that the department suddenly became a school and Elwell had freedom to hire people?
No, I don't think so.
Mm.
It may have been facilitated by the fact that Gomlitz, who wanted me, had only Elwell to persuade.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't necessary to go another layer up to, say, Mark Ingram's office as dean of the Letters and Science School. But that's all.
Several other people came that year. That is, there's Ratcliffe and
Dick Ratcliffe.
Shields had come the year before.
Who?
Ratcliffe and Shields, is that right?
John Shields. Well, John, as I recall, was an attorney here in town, and he taught our business law course, but it wasn't a permanent full-time faculty position.
And then the year you came, it's Center, Kramer, Dine. These are people listed on the faculty. The Hostler, Knight, Moberly, Strang.
Yes. Many of them came later.
Oh, they may have come the next.
Yes.
Yeah.
Strang, for example, is still in the faculty. Well, at that time, he was much more than a boy.
No, he was just a lecturer. Could you describe what the school was like when you joined the faculty? What was your impression of it?
Well, that's a difficult question, and I don't really know how to approach it. We moved from the fourth floor of Sterling Hall into the new building, which was, of course, a very happy development for all concerned, because in Sterling Hall, commerce had the fourth floor, economics the third floor, and physics had the rest of the building from there on down into the basement. So it was enormously crowded.
When you say the new building?
The new commerce school building, just below Bascom. On the hill, across from the social studies building.
But that's back up in the 50s or 60s, isn't it? I didn't write down the date of the
it would have been maybe a 50.
All right.
We weren't too long in Sterling Hall.
I see. Okay.
Because our faculty offices in Sterling Hall were little cubby holes, mm-hmm. 8 feet wide and 12 feet long kind of thing. You put in two desks butting up against each other. You had a wall covered with your books, and that was the office for two members of the faculty. And I shared one of those spaces 1 year with Baird Taylor, now that I had reached the dignity of being an assistant professor and no longer a graduate student. And then another year or two with Irv Gomlitz. And then we moved out into the new building where, of course, faculty had individual offices.
Mm. I guess I really meant how what the school was like academically. I mean, you had taught at Missouri.
It's difficult to compare them because at that time I think the major department in the school here, or the department here of commerce, was accounting. It still is the strongest and the biggest, but other departments have developed so that it's not quite so much a one-legged course of study, a one-legged program. Missouri, what they called the school there, was the Business and Public Administration, BNPA, and it was kind of a hodgepodge which combined into one school what in Wisconsin were three separate departments, that is business, economics, and political science, with no great strength in any of them, nor in the combination. So you can't, it's an apples and oranges sort of comparison.
Was there did Elwell have an underlying philosophy of what a business school should be that you could describe?
If there was, and I don't know that there was, I question first. It was solely to turn out accounting graduates, period. That's really all he was interested in doing. I attended a funeral service here about a week ago for a woman who had been for years in our accounting faculty, Miss Angela Linz.
Oh, yes. Huh.
And sat with three good friends who had all been students of my generation, who had all been students at one time in the School of Business and had known Miss Linz then as a young instructor in the school. Well, if there was ever a person treated unfairly, it was she. She was a woman, she was single. First place, she's a woman, therefore she's inferior. This is Faye Elwell's thinking. Therefore she's inferior. Second, she's single, she doesn't need much salary. And for umpteen years, as long as Faye was dean, and Miss Linz was in that department, she was dumped on. Most unjustly. There was another woman who I didn't know. Now, I never did any work in accounting here, so I know nothing about them except as one knows associates in a faculty named Hensley. I think it was Irene Hensley. Mm-hmm. She was driven away, as I recall, by Faye. Faye couldn't endure anybody in his faculty who wasn't very subservient, who had any opinions. He was omniscient and omnipotent. I certainly hope that all this personal...
Well, it's all right. It's the truth.
Well, I know, but I don't want it to go in any kind of record. Never speak ill of the dead. And why should I be saying this? I hope it won't be put anywhere.
As I say, it's a research document, and it will be backed up by many, I am sure, many written documents in the archive. So it isn't as if you're the only one who's expressing such a view. Irene, this is just while you're talking about her, or Angeline Linz. Was she a good teacher?
I judge so from what was said by these men at her funeral service last week, that they enjoyed her, that she worked hard and was interested in the students. I remember, again, referring to Faye Elwell, that one of them had taken a car, and he's a very eminent head of an accounting firm here today, about retired, I suppose. And said that, well, Faye spent all his time in the courses talking about some of their graduates and how they were moving up in the world with accounting firms here and there. He never really taught the subject. And another male professor, dead now, who was treated about as unjustly as Miss Lynn's was by Elwell.
Would that have been Orner or Fellows? Or?
No. They were in a different field. They were in marketing.
Hmm. Fox?
Gibson.
Gibson. Oh, John Gibson, yes.
Yeah. Well, as I say, these three men I sat with at the services, in reference to Gibby, as everybody knew him, said all he wanted to do was talk sports, football or whatnot. Miss Lynn's was the one who, and before, with her, Miss Hensley, I guess, were the ones who really did the best teaching. Oh, but the faculty, the senior faculty then in economics, I knew far better than I knew faculty in commerce, as odd as it may seem. Partly because I had been their student, and they were still on the scene, you see. When I came back, I was here as an assistant professor. There was Ed Witte, who's W.H. Kiekhofer, Martin Glaser. The name of the man who taught economic history, it doesn't come to me now. Jim Early at that time was just a young, still wet behind the ears assistant professor, retired now out in California from one of their schools. But those people I knew well. I was their student, and with Early, at least there were some social contacts. But as far as people in commerce, I didn't take courses with any of them as a graduate student, except for my Baird Taylor, my major professor. He had an experience later on after the war with Fay Elwell that was comparable, at least, to mine with that little scholarship grant. Baird had developed a textbook in corporate finance. There was necessarily a good bit of accounting material in this textbook. The dean had a copy, whether Baird had given it to him or not. But Elwell, instead, as you might normally think, congratulating him on the production of a good and well-received text, simply told him that his accounting in it was terrible. Picture the man. Well, that was about the straw that broke Baird Taylor's back, I think, because he went out to California very soon thereafter, became academic vice president of a complex of colleges. Why can't I remember the name? Down in Southern California.
You don't mean the Pomona?
Yes.
Claremont?
Oh. Yes, that group. Hmm. Well, he retired as academic vice president there. Just died 2-3 years ago, recently.
That's at least. Otherwise, it would be useless, wouldn't it?
Well, I suppose. Well, so far, we've only been talking about the period of approximately 1937 when I came here to graduate school into about 1950 or whatever the time.
I do have another question, you move ahead.
Please do.
You join what has just become a school, and how was it run? Were there meetings of the faculty? How were decisions made?
Looking back, there were few faculty meetings of the school under Dean Elwell. There were none that I can recall. Well, I have no way of recalling, because at the time I wasn't a member of the faculty when he was chairman of the department. I was not then a member. I was a graduate student, so I wouldn't know it then for that period. But later, There were very few so-called faculty meetings.
And
when there were, it was simply that we were receiving instructions from on high. There was no participative government that I can recall at all. Now that changed 180 degrees when he retired and Irv Gomlitz became then dean of the school.
So Elwell, who made appointments then? Who appointed faculty?
He did.
So are you here, Barry?
The school,
yes.
So to speak,
yes.
The governance.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was just a complete reversal when Irv became dean. If anything, in time, the faculty became bored with long meetings and long discussions. Too much candy.
That was in about 56 or so,
whenever,
is that right?
I couldn't.
When Gomlitz became dean?
I suppose. I don't remember.
Or 58. Possibly, but
the late 50s.
Mm-hmm. So there wasn't. You don't really talk as if you felt as if you belonged to the school. I mean, was there any sense of collegiality among the faculty?
There was other. I think, looking back again, that the only cohesion within the faculty of the department or school was largely social, because we were not a cohesive unit in terms of planning curriculum, for example, making decisions that involve the school as a whole.
Mm. You didn't have any share in that?
No, I don't recall anything. Everything came from the dean's office. This is what we're going to do. This is it.
Any discussion of this among faculty members? And
well, by this time, Fay was so relatively powerful relative to any individual faculty, and he'd gone from the success of converting a department into a school and of getting a building that. How could the faculty even unitedly revolt, as it were?
Hmm.
All we could do is wait for him to die or retire.
It doesn't sound like a very happy setup.
It wasn't. But a fair number of the faculty, you see, had no basis for knowing how unhappy they were or how bad things were, because they'd never been anyplace else. They'd never been in other universities or colleges.
You've got a number of your own graduates as new faculty members?
Apparently, I think. It was simply that one man kept the entire department very much and strongly and firmly under his thumb.
Mm-hmm.
Don't call me, I'll get you when I want you. Yeah. That kind of attitude.
How was he on deciding salaries?
Niggardly. Because one of the things that he always took pride in was his unit instructional cost. How many students can we teach per dollar of salary? You know, so we look good in comparison to other schools and departments.
Mm.
The accounting, strictly the accounting bottom line point of view.
Mm-hmm. What was the school's reputation nationally at that time?
I really don't know. I think it was well regarded in the one area of accounting, and perhaps. But beyond that, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It might have been, let's put it that way. I know it has, in the years since then, accomplished a good bit of recognition on the national scene. It's not a Harvard school or nor a Stanford. And I spent a year at Stanford, visiting professor, and could have spent the rest of my life there, so I learned a bit about it. Mm-hmm. But our Midwestern roots were too deep, and in spite of all the attractions, came back here to Wisconsin. Mm-hmm.
It was as if you didn't belong to the department. Did you keep your ties with people in economics?
Well, what happened, of course, was that the generation of faculty there, those I've named, for example, were passing out of the picture. Mm-hmm. Kiekhofer died, cancer. Woody passed away, Glazier. About the only one of that group still in economics was Jim Early, who was a very young assistant professor, you see. Mm-hmm. And Walter Morton.
Yes. Did you know him?
I took a course in my graduate work, his course in money and banking. later on, I never took one graduate seminar with Kiekhofer, although for a couple of years I was also teaching quiz sections in his famous Econ 1A, 1B mm-hmm. course. Morton asked me if I would take quiz sections for him in money and banking, but I had all I could manage between Baird Taylor and Irv Gomlitz's courses and their sections, and personally I preferred it that way. Morton was such a gold-plated character. You can get people who knew him better than I to talk about him.
He's been rather extensively talked about.
a genuine character, if there ever was one. Mm. he was as much as Fay Elwell. Entirely different, but certainly they were individuals.
He was cross-listed in commerce, wasn't he?
A lot of those people were mm-hmm. cross-listed, com econ or econ com.
I just wondered how Morton and Elwell got along.
Well, I don't think they spoke two words to each other in 10 years. They couldn't have gotten along. Each one was too strong. Mm-hmm.
What was the basis of
Elwell's? It would have made a grand fight between two bulls. yes.
What was the basis of Elwell's strength? Where did it come from?
I don't know his history, because you see, he was chairman of the department when I came here as a graduate student. So how he got to that point, I don't know. It was purely dominance. I think he had to report to Mark Ingram, as long as Commerce was a department in Letters and Science. They hated each other like cat and dog. I think they avoided each other as much as possible. And of course, Mark was a very strong man too, mm. although on the whole much more intelligent and reasonable, I think, than Fay Elwell. I can't answer your question.
What about his link with the legislature?
I don't know any detail at all. I think that he simply lobbied legislators. He could be nice, flattering to people who could do something for him. And I think he lobbied the legislature. I know he did. Mm. You see, the regents at that point, as I recall, had not approved the building of a school of commerce, the new building. So he simply said, to hell with you. I'm going to the legislature. And did that, and made it work. Mm. Evidence of a lot of things in a man, isn't it?
So it wasn't that he was close friends with legislators?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think if I may be, again continue to be in this very uncomplimentary vein, I think he toadied to people in politics who were important. A Republican governor, for example, could have Fay do anything. Mm-hmm.
That was one of the, did you have anything to do with the issue of the school for management and the school for workers?
No. School for workers, Jack Barbish? No. School for management, who was that? I don't remember now.
I think Elwell organized it.
I don't remember.
But you had nothing to do with that?
No.
Did politics play any role in the school at that time? I know Elwell was very conservative, and there were a number of liberals in the economics department. He talks about it, and Nathan Feinsinger does. I just wonder if you have any comment about.
Well, they were simply poles apart politically in terms of values. Some of the econ people were, by standards of that day, ultra-liberals. Mm-hmm. Elwell was probably about as conservative a Republican as you could find. How do you bring them together? Especially when everybody is taking the position, my mind's made up, don't bother me with facts, I don't want to reason with you.
Did Elwell have any input or any reaction, do you know, did you ever hear anything about it, to the whole McCarthy era?
I have no knowledge. I wouldn't know on that. I can assume that he was very favorably inclined, at least until McCarthy's was cut down. Mm.
But it didn't come up as an issue.
No. You see, you're on the national level of politics. McCarthy was a senator, and as far as the commerce area is concerned here, that was strictly a state level situation to deal with the state legislature to get approval for this, money for that, and so forth. Mm.
I just meant in terms of being worrying about having communists around or anything like that.
No, I don't think so.
So you were all more or less marking time until he would retire. I mean, did you ever consider going anywhere else?
Yes. Stanford invited me out. And it would have been very easy to stay there, maybe a very flattering proposal, involved in a promotion from assistant to associate professor with an appropriate salary readjustment. Mm. And of course, the Stanford of 1950 or 49 or whenever it was a very attractive place, not the boomtown six-lane highway place that it is today, or that I understand. Here it is. Mm-hmm. And it was a very, very, very difficult decision for Libby and myself as to do we stay there in California and try to make a career there, or do we come back here to Madison? And it was largely personal reasons, but we were both Midwesterners. My mother was alive here. She had a brother and a little family around, and we loved Madison. So that against all the attractions of California and Stanford, we came back. But by that time, Irv Gomlitz had reached a point with Fay Elwell. And Irv's technique was never confront, never argue. Honey catches more flies than vinegar, absolutely. Where Elwell would listen to him, and at least sometimes be influenced by Irv. And it was really Irv's friendship and respect for me that brought me along in this faculty, because almost immediately after our Stanford experience, I was promoted to associate professor here, and only a year later to full professor.
So you think that was Gomnitz's doing rather than Elwell's?
Oh, certainly. If Gomnitz hadn't been in the picture, I would have spent 40 years in the mines as a nobody.
Yeah.
Or at least, so long as Fay was running the show.
Was there anybody else in the school that he would listen to?
I don't think so. No.
So you were all in the same.
We were all dirt. Will you excuse me? I want to step into the washroom. Better unhook here.
Was it a foregone conclusion that Gomnitz would be dean?
Pretty much, simply because he'd been assistant dean to Elwell.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Long enough, and he was very popular and very well liked, and in the faculty, so there was no one would have dreamt of objecting to his appointment. In fact, we were also happy to see Fay go. We would have taken almost anything, and we're happy to get Irv simply because Irv was very well liked.
What did he do then when he became dean?
Well, he unleashed the faculty simply in terms of bringing us together through faculty meetings. You had this disorganized group of people who were, sure, we were all in the Department of Commerce, the School of Commerce, but we weren't a group as such, working as a group. And Herb would get us together a couple of times a semester, I suppose. We'd spend an hour or two, or at least, be discussing the school and anything that came up. He'd had a little agenda, but it was wide open. Mm-hmm. So I think he made he brought about some unity.
Is the school organized by departments?
Yes.
And who makes decisions about appointments?
Same as it's done in other schools, I suppose. The dean has, as I understand it, and how these things are done today, I have no idea. The dean has the final say-so, but he has to listen to all the faculty.
I guess what I meant was, what is the procedure did you look for faculty on the basis of a new direction for the school?
In some, I'm sure that was the case. I'm thinking of Management Institute. Well, we had to find somebody to head the thing, and we did. And it's unfortunate that the first selection wasn't a good one, but that's neither here nor there. We did go out and look and try.
Who was that?
Moberly.
Hmm.
They could hardly wait to get rid of him, as I recall the case. No, I don't want this. I'm being so uncomplimentary today, and I don't like it.
Well,
I don't like me because of that.
That's all right. So did Gomnitz have a philosophy for the school?
Just improve, grow. If you had asked him to detail one, yes, he could sit down and write you a document, but I don't think he ever sat. He would have given it much thought until the request came. just work at the problems and the weaknesses as they arose. Mm-hmm. I don't think he had any grand goals, no, in terms of a philosophy.
Were there divisions between, as for instance in economics, there are between the econometrics and the old style economics? Was any kind of division like that in the business school?
I don't think so, because you see the division in economics that you're referring to, as I understand it, and look at it today. If you go back, the Wisconsin Department of Economics was described as being devoted to institutional economics. This began with John R. Commons. Incidentally, I had the honor of being his last graduate assistant after he had retired and came back for a summer session. So I got to know the old gentleman a little bit. In other words, I'll put it this way, if I may step back. Mm-hmm. I had graduated from Knox College, liking very much a professor of economics there who was a Harvard PhD. And 5 years later, when I was bumping my head in a city high school against the salary structure and getting tired of coaching football and of working with high school kids, I wrote to him and said I would like to get a master's degree in economics, and where do you think I should go, or what schools do you suggest? Well, he said the three leading schools in the United States are Harvard, Chicago, and Wisconsin. Well, Harvard was, I was married, we had two children. I had married my Knox College sweetheart. Harvard was like going to the moon from the Midwest. Chicago, I'd spent a summer working there, and I just despise such huge cities and the life that has one. Commuting, the family is miles away from where you work and that sort of thing. Madison was perfection because it let us, and remember we weren't very wealthy, of course. We lived our summers in the tent colony.
No, I want you to talk about that.
Okay.
At some point.
We loved the outdoors. We loved the tent colony life, even though it wore Libby down to a skin and bone. And it was close to all of our family. So the decision to come to Wisconsin was very simple. I didn't know anything about more than that, about those departments or what their orientations were. But at that time, you see, Wisconsin was still had a great reputation nationally for institutional economics, more so. Others were just beginning, there was the beginning development. I suppose it may have arisen with the computer age of the econometrics, the ability to handle enormous amounts of data. But what happened, looking back now from sometime in the 1930s to sometime in the 1950s, was that institutional economics as such simply ceased to exist. Elementary courses became much more courses in economic theory. You don't study an institution such as banking, the Federal Reserve System, whatever. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Were we going somewhere in particular? Were you leading me on with that? I don't know whether I got there.
I had asked you whether there was any kind of division between old and new in the business school, and you were contrasting it to the
that sort of a development did not occur in the area among business schools generally, their curricula remained pretty much what they were. There wasn't this drastic change in ideology or methodology. So this area of education, it's just been a development, improvement, growth in all these days, in decades.
You say Elwell wanted to have the, what is the term for it, to have the least expensive credit program?
Yeah.
Was Gomnitz a penny pincher?
No, he tried. He tried to get money for salary. Mm-hmm.
Did he succeed?
Modestly. Excuse me. Have you visited?
I haven't talked to anybody about it. This is tape two of the interview with Charles Center. Yes, talk about the Tent Colony.
Well, the Tent Colony was a unique University of Wisconsin institution. We met at first, we became acquainted at first with a summer session in 1934. It was on the lakeshore below where the present student houses are. The university at that time had perhaps 30 or 40 wooden platforms, all identical, 12 feet by 20 feet, which in that depression year one could rent for the summer for $5, married students only. And then each couple or family erected on this 12 by 20 foot platform anything they wanted in the way of shelter, which involved a great amount of scrounging, junkyards, used lumber places, or whatever you could get that you might put up a roof over your head with. It was interesting. Most of us learned to build a wood framework with any junk lumber we could get that would be about 3 feet high all the way around, except for a screen door, which we'd have to find in a dump somewhere. And then the next 3 feet would be cheesecloth, muslin, keep the mosquitoes out but allow some air and light in. The bottom 3 feet you'd cover with black tar paper to make it reasonably weatherproof, waterproof. Then you had a 3 foot layer, and then you close in the back end as best you could. You'd cover the whole thing with a big tarpaulin. You build a frame up this style and a ridge pole, a big tarpaulin like this. And the tarpaulin had to be big enough so that in rainy, stormy weather, you could unroll it and have it come down to the level of the tar paper, cover your muslin windows.
You had to buy the tar.
Yeah. A lot of us, I suppose generally, most people had a roof of two or three tarps, simply because one big one was too expensive and they could manage to somehow or other get their hands on a few odd ones. Oh, it was a case of happy poverty. Two wells, you have to carry all the water you wanted. Swimming every day, the university put out a pier. And that was the community bath. The old-fashioned chick sails, two or three of them along the hillside to take care of that necessity. And it was fun for young couples, just lots of fun.
Where did you cook?
Oh, you build it inside your little house. You build a long cupboard somewhere, usually down across the end where you put your door. And if you could, you'd pick up a fourth-hand sink and build into that, and then with some kind of pipe or tubing, run that down through the floor, drain your dishwater and wastewater out on the ground beneath your platform. And cooking was always a two-burner Coleman gasoline stove. And usually you had a gasoline lantern, a couple of flashlights, no electricity. The milk truck came through every day. There used to be a hellacious competition between the liberals and the conservatives in the camp. The liberals all insisting that we should buy our milk from the newly formed co-op, while the conservatives preferred to buy it from Bowman or an ice truck would come through.
Did both the milk trucks come through, both sides?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, they're as competitive as could be. The ice truck would come through, and again, you'd been to the secondhand stores and found yourself a little wooden ice box of some kind. The old-fashioned wood ice boxes, which nowadays people convert into bars or whatever. Mm-hmm. That takes care of cooking, sanitation.
And did you have beds, or did you sleep on the
floor? You had beds as best you could. Some people had cots. Had to be light, portable, and cheap. Mm-hmm.
Did you really save a lot of money? It sounds to me as if you must have had to buy enough things that
everything that I've talked about buying, you would buy secondhand or fourth hand.
Then you could find them.
And about the only thing, you had to go buy a roll of muslin, and you had to go buy a roll of tar paper. Mm-hmm. But those were cheap things. A Coleman gasoline stove then cost $3 maybe.
And you could get the gas easily.
Oh, yeah, white gas you had to pick up someplace. Furniture was anything you can scrounge, as long as it didn't cost anything.
It can be cold in the summer sometimes.
Not really. I don't remember. I can remember lots of super hot days when we all went down and jumped in the lake. I can remember thunderstorms coming across Lake Mendota and blowing down some of our mansions. I don't really remember any cold weather in the mid-June to mid-August, the eight-week summer session, whatever that ran. And there were 30 or 40 families there, and we had a government, a local government, with a committee for everything you could think about, and very few of which ever had to do anything, so it worked out quite well.
Where did you grocery shop?
In on University Avenue. The stores, whatever. And there was parking up above on the road, which is now the road, you know, the paved road that goes around the lake shore there, mm-hmm. behind the student houses. Well, that was all gravel, but it was wide enough that we all could park up in there. Where university houses are was then farm fields. And we'd occasionally have a baseball game or something like that up there. My very good and longtime friend, Professor Robert Bray in agriculture, who retired not too long ago as Associate Dean of the College of Agriculture, was living, I'm not so sure whether this was before World War II or immediately after, with his bride. The little farmhouse that stood on those fields where the student, married student apartments are today. Hmm. Although we didn't really get to know the Brays very well until the late 40s. And we don't have no better friends today.
Hmm. Was this an important source of friendships, or did the group mostly disperse?
It dispersed. Most of those students were in the College of Education. Most of them were high school teachers taking work to, or in a few instances they were working on graduate degrees or taking courses. There weren't very many there outside of the College of Education, as I recall. So there were teachers from around the state pretty much. There were some friendships that came from that. I still have one couple today who live in the country down near Waukesha that I see every year, maybe. Mm-hmm. Very good friends. And as recently as, and for a period of maybe 20 years afterward, we would exchange Christmas cards with the friends that we'd made in the tent colony.
How many years did you live there?
We were there about three, perhaps four summers, from the summer of 37 to the summer of 40.
So your wife enjoyed it?
She put up with it. No. Our financial arrangements were such that we would live in the tent colony in the summer. Then when it closed down, and in September, with the start of the fall semester, we had to find some place to live through the winter months until the following summer, so that two of those years we occupied summer cottages, and I do mean summer cottages, on the shore of Lake Mendota.
Oof.
Well, there were $20 a month for rent, and of course it wasn't easy. It wasn't fun the way the summer in the tent colony. We were just surviving the seasons.
What, did you have cast iron stoves or for heating?
One of them, at least, we lived with our two burner Coleman.
But I mean,
one of them had an oil heater put in for us. You know, when these square thing stoves that stand out in the middle of the room.
Yeah.
Another one, I picked up a little cast iron stove and installed. And another winter we spent in the second floor of a house with an old couple living on the first floor of the owner's. It's a very tiny little bungalow on South Orchard Street. That was the only time in her life Libby ever had a nervous breakdown. We had two children cooped up in the second floor. The old couple downstairs who were disturbed by
the noise,
anything and everything. I don't realize, I didn't appreciate at the time everything that she was doing and putting up with. And if it were possible to go back, I'd be much more appreciative than I was.
Yeah, people didn't think about it then.
No, we all took it for granted. We took so much for granted.
Do you want to say, I know you want to talk about the Faculty Association. Do you want to say anything about your own teaching, your field, how your ideas about teaching insurance and changed?
Well, early on, when I came into the scene here, the instruction in insurance was very institutional, just as instruction in banking might have been. And therefore, with the development of curricula, it began to lose its such approaches to instruction. Began to lose attraction, to lose support. For example, one might say, why if you're going to offer a course in banking or in insurance, why don't you offer one in lumber yards? And it's a valid question. So that the evolution that took place in the 60s was to move away from the institutions which were involved, rather to study and work on the functions that were performed by these institutions and by other techniques or devices or other institutions offering the same function, the same service. In this instance, excuse me, I'm getting a little stiff. I've got a bad leg here. It was recognized by the sometime in the late 50s that we really ought not be just teaching courses which are institutional insurance. But what we were really trying to do was to recognize the fact that in business life and in personal life, for each and every one of us, there are many risks which you have to confront. You make a decision or you fail to make a decision. Failing to make a decision in itself is, of course, a decision. So that we, there are a good many procedures, devices, which we use to, so that we can live with these risks. Then it becomes a question of judgment as to which ones do you use with respect to a particular risk. For example, the whole area of prevention. Prevent the risks of causing a loss. A widely used technique. We don't think about it as such, but you can see, I think. Or somewhat related to that, I suppose, if you can't prevent its occurring, what can you do to limit the cost of the loss? You can't prevent lightning, but maybe, and I don't know for sure, but maybe lightning rods at this cost of X dollars might prevent a loss which otherwise would be X to the nth power of dollars. So you can perhaps prevent completely or simply limit the undesirable consequences of the occurrence. Well, there are other techniques. The development of reserves. You know something about housekeeping, I'm positive. Well, sometimes it's just inconvenient to have to go out and get some groceries. You maintain a reserve of groceries in the cupboard against that risk of being inconvenienced. That's a small and a very petty kind of a thing. But you do that in the financial world. You maintain reserves. The individual does it with his personal finances, the business, the maintenance of reserves against costs. All right. Well, insurance, of course, is perhaps the biggest and most widely used method of handling the costs of risks. But what the whole approach did simply was to broaden the perspective.
Was this something in the national thinking at the time?
It developed nationally. It developed nationally. There were two universities in the country then which were leading historically in this subject area. One was the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania. The other was Wisconsin, as we built it in the 1950s.
Were you involved at the beginning of this? You were developing the ideas yourself.
Well, I don't want to claim a lot of originality. These things simply came along. A lot of us in the teaching side saw that we would have to broaden our perspectives, our our views of what we were doing and what we were trying to accomplish, that if we simply stayed as instructors in a particular institution, as the institution of the insurance industry, it was a losing battle in almost any school's curriculum. There are still some that do that. But we said, let's simply take the point of view that we're not teaching insurance, but we're teaching risk management, how to cope. And that's what's done today. This is a development that took place over 5-10 years at least in the thinking. And there are still some schools which don't accept it, but they're very minor. You see, we had we developed here in the 50s and 60s a major. We had about as many PhDs and master's degrees with majors in this field as the University of Pennsylvania, which had untold financial resources for scholarships and fellowships. I have no idea how many MBA and PhDs I've worked with. It would be well over 100 degree holders who received degrees, not just took courses.
Excuse me.
But
when you change your whole approach to teaching it, you've been teaching the insurance business, and suddenly you're talking about risk management. You must have to change your courses and
you change your course content.
How did you go? About doing that? Did you do a lot of reading or go take courses yourself somewhere?
No, you think it out for yourself.
You thought it out.
You think it out for yourself, pretty much. There's a world of literature on loss. Loss control and loss prevention in industry, mainly. You can find shelves and shelves of that sort of thing if you're looking for case studies or whatever. No, it was just pretty much a case of think it out for yourself and then find the materials to support it, what you're talking about. But it's a change of emphasis. You just don't start in and instruct on the institution of the insurance, the industry, and its function. You put it into the bigger context as being a major, very major technique by which we handle many different kinds of risks. The risk of the cost of a premature death, of the house burning down, of being sued for all these risks we simply put on the backs of an insurance company.
Was there a year when you remember offering a differently organized course?
No year, not really. This was a kind of an evolution over several years. As your own thinking grew and your supporting materials that you could use in the instruction became available as you discovered them. No, it was a slow growth. It wasn't a flash of lightning.
Did you change the title of your courses?
Yes. Instead of Principles of Insurance, it became Principles of Risk Management.
So if I found that in a catalog, I'd know what year you finally pinned it all down. Is that right? Do you remember?
No.
But you say the late 1950s?
I would more likely into the 60s sometime. More likely is in the 60s. And the department as it exists today, much more limited form than it used to be, but it's now the Department of Risk Management and Insurance. I think that's what they're calling it.
Were insurance companies pleased or concerned that their people wouldn't be trained in the same way that they had been?
No, like I don't think they were aware. If they'd been aware, I don't think they would have been concerned. If they'd been concerned, we would have said, you do your job and we'll do ours. By and large, I think the insurance industry looked upon us in the quiet. I may have to go put them out. I don't know what that yip means. as a source of prospective personnel who had some speaking acquaintanceship with the organization and functions of the industry, I hope they thought that we were, even those students who passed through some of our courses and would never have any intention of or going into the insurance industry for a career, would be better and wiser consumers of insurance, or of other, better able to judge whether to buy insurance or not. Of course, any insurance man will say insurance is the only the answer, you know, always. But that maybe they didn't appreciate that we were saying, no, it's not. There are other ways, and you should think about them before you simply go buy insurance. But I don't think that we didn't set off any major explosions. It was a mild evolution, mm-hmm. rather than a revolution.
So you had many graduate students. You showed me a plaque in there that your students had made.
Yes. Oh. This was not due to any Machiavellian approach on my part, but simply as I got into the teaching in the late 40s, and we had, you know, the post-war mob of ex-GIs, and I found that for whatever reasons, I was having every semester in this basic course an enrollment of somewhere between 200 and 400. It meant the biggest lecture hall available. So I used the biology auditorium, that old T-16 temporary, which has been torn down for some years, the auditorium and ag hall, Bascom auditorium, whatever that room number is. And some of those kids would come on through then to take second level courses that we offered in the department. And that gave me a good chance to get to know and to pick and choose the real bright up and comers. And I frankly am proselyted. I said, would you be interested in going on? And eventually, I think I was very lucky that I found a lot of young fellows who were smarter than I was. and to have the pleasure of working with them. And eventually, a lot of them became my teaching assistants. I think of some few I'm still in touch with. My first teaching assistant had been a major in the Army, South Pacific. He had no more interest in the North. I just liked him. I was younger, those students were older. There wasn't the generation gap, you know. We could talk as friend to friend outside class. I spotted him. I thought, there's an awfully good looking, able looking guy. Got acquainted, found out he was indeed. So he stayed. Became my first teaching assistant. He just retired a year ago as vice chancellor of the University of Colorado. So that was not a bad selection, was it? Another one started an insurance company here 25, 30 years ago to insure the kinds of bad automobile drivers, automobile risks, that nobody else in the insurance business wanted, you know, too many accidents. So he set up a company that would take only those guys. But the premium was three or four times otherwise, and he didn't have any selling expense because the companies who were turning him down would simply refer them. eventually, his company was so successful that it was bought by what was then Century Insurance, and you know the name up in Stevens Point. Made a multimillionaire out of him. Well, if money is the measure of success, there's another one. A kid who took what he followed the track. That's all. In his direction, he was always money hungry. He got it. He just died of cancer a year ago. I think of two more who had management consulting firms, one of them in San Francisco, one of them in Chicago. They branched out. They can't get away from what they learned here, or the influences that their university education had on them, but they're broadened very greatly. One more came here with his wife. They came from Sauk City originally. Both he and his wife. And he is now getting close to retirement as president and chief executive officer of a complex of insurance companies based in Washington, D.C., which serve primarily service people in all the military branches. When he went in with them, they were a small, struggling operation. Today they're a multi-million, billion, and his salary, I'm told, is now $500,000 a year.
Speaking of which, were you ever tempted to go into the business world yourself?
I got so involved in the lives of all these young people, I never really was. This fellow in Washington, there's an interesting story there, because he's got a chip on his shoulder as far as the university is concerned because of a very minor thing. His given names are Leslie Page, so he was getting mail addressed to Miss, I won't give you his last name, Miss Leslie Page blank. It really offended him. he told me about that, Les.
Just start that sentence again.
The school business now, just to finish this little story about Les, is out for, I think it's $8 million for its new building, which has to come from private sources. So I received recently from the dean of the school a list of prospective donors and so forth and so forth. And could I add any to it? Well, I immediately sent back Les's full name and address, and I said, look, why don't you go after his companies to set up a major grant in his honor at his retirement, because he's and if that fails, hit him individually, but you could get a lot more from the companies if you do it. You could put that over.
I hope it works.
Well, I do too. They ought to be able to come through with a gift of $500,000 right there if they want to. I mean, I've seen their statements. They can certainly afford it. It's just a case of being persuaded. Well, I say my real pleasure was in sorting out and then bringing along all these bright fellows, everyone as different as can be, and working with them, and I don't think there was ever too much of a boss, superior, inferior. It was always very much on a personal, good friends kind of a basis. I had one man come from Egypt in the late 40s. Ended up with a PhD, came from a very well-to-do family. His wife was from a very well-to-do family in Egypt. And that started a flow. I suppose I had a half a dozen other Egyptians and Syrians who came for graduate work. One of them is an official in the University of Kuwait. One of them is a professor at the University of Saskatchewan. One of them's professor at the University of Utah. They sort of stand out in the crowd. I mean, that these, the only group of foreign students that I had were Egyptians and Syrians. Mm-hmm. It just started with this one young man.
Yeah. And you say, after you retired and you had refused to have a retirement dinner, that some of your graduates
they flim-flammed me. Dick Hines, who was one of my early mid-50s, I suppose, got his PhD with me and then got a law degree, was on our faculty until 2 or 3 years ago on a part-time basis, even though for the last decade he's been working with CUNA Mutual out on Mineral Point Road and is now their president. So he had to give up his part-time faculty appointment, mm-hmm. Which was a shame because he was a wonderful teacher, one of the best I ever knew in terms of communicating with students. Well, Dick was the one who got the ball rolling on that surprise party, the roast. Mm-hmm. And as I say, it was within less than 24 hours that I found out that he'd flim-flam me and that what was going to be a fundraiser for our students was just a chance to get even with the old guy.
And they gave you a nice plaque. That
oh, yes. It almost brought me to tears. It still does when I think about it. Mm. No, I've been very happy. I've never regretted any opportunities that might have come my way and that were declined, simply because of these fellows that are still my friends and younger brothers, so to speak, mm-hmm. Today. And when Mary and I were married 4 years ago, she is my second marriage for both of us. We each have 5 grown up and gone. So we've done our share for the human race. Just a small family wedding, and then we threw a reception up here at Black Hawk Country Club for friends. I had one man come, former student, Washington, D.C., come. John Cooey, the Vice Chancellor of the University of Colorado, come from Denver. Yeah. You can't buy that sort of friendship.
Quite a testimonial. Well, this is, we scheduled this interview very quickly. We talked about it yesterday.
Yes, exactly.
So that I am not, do not have all the questions. I know that I want to ask you, you have not yet talked about the Faculty Association.
No.
So I would like to continue
this. It's quarter after 11.
Yeah, and I'm going to have to leave pretty soon.
Well, why do we even begin? Why don't we just stop at
that's
this
what I'm
point
saying.
And
that's agreeable. Let's stop and then we will carry on.